older than the Republic, I said. Yes. They date to the reign of King Tarquinius Superbus, when the first temple of Jupiter was built. The greatest of all Etruscan artisans, a fellow named Vulca, not only designed the temple, but also created the statuary. All that remains is what you see here. I should think such precious artifacts would be stored in the temple itself. Yes, one might think that, but massive as it is, even the Temple of Jupiter had only so much storage space. All those Sibylline books in the basement, you know, and a great many sacred phalluses, I'm told, some of them quite large, and all very ancient, much older than the temple itself, and who knows what else. But how did you acquire these pieces? Well, it wasn't I who acquired them. It was my ancestors. But how? Who knows? Not I. And if not I, then nobody. Some great-great-grand somebody or other got his hands on them. And here they are. I tell people they've been in the family forever, but literally speaking, that's not true, of course. Even we Brutai haven't existed forever. Almost, but not quite. The gods are elder. He produced a barking laugh. What do you say, mother? He turned to a tall woman wearing a simple yellow stola who had just entered the room. Who's elder than us? Some say the Julii, and maybe they are. If it's true, they descended from Venus. Venus must be even older than you, eh, mother? He laughed again, then stepped aside, ceding to his mother the focal point of the room where she could see and be seen by her guests. Who are these people? She said brusquely, despite her son's jocular tone. Servilia wasn't a woman to be taken lightly. With her greying hair piled atop her head, her erect bearing, and her chin held high, she was a very picture of a patrician matron. Brutus had joked about her age, but at 50, Servilia was still quite attractive. I could see why Caesar had taken her as a lover when they were both much younger, and much to the consternation of Servilia's brother, Cato. A lingering sentimental attachment might explain why the dictator was so indulgent and forgiving of Servilia's son, despite his opposition to Caesar in the war. This man, mother, is called Gordianus the Finder, and the younger fellow, well, by Hercules, I'm sure the slave told me, but now I've forgotten. Not one of your adopted sons, is he? Not quite. Davis is my son-in-law. Ah, yes, that's it. Gordianus the Finder and his son-in-law, Davis. Why have you abandoned your other visitor to see this fellow? Said Servilia. You have important business to attend to. How well I know, mother. But dear old Cicero once told me, should Gordianus the Finder ever come calling, I would do well to see him. The fellow can be quite irritating, but he usually has something interesting to say, and he's never frivolous. Well, from Cicero, that's quite a compliment. Servilia looked me up and down, as if by sight she could determine the accuracy of Cicero's statement. Well, then, she said, sounding impatient, say something interesting, Finder, or prove my son's beloved Cicero a liar. Before I could answer, and to my relief, another figure entered the room. From the way she carried herself, I knew she must be the mistress of the house. Portia, Brutus's new wife and also his cousin. And she was rather plain to look at, but her marriage was said to be a genuine love match. Portia had been a young widow with a child when Brutus divorced his previous wife to marry her. Certainly Brutus couldn't have improved his standing with the dictator by marrying the orphaned daughter of Caesar's bitterest enemy. Cato, Portia's father, Servilia's brother, and Brutus's uncle, was dead, but not forgotten. After Cato's messy suicide in Africa, Brutus, a protege of both Caesar and Cato, had published a eulogy praising his uncle's steadfast republican virtues. Copies proliferated and were posted all over the city. Caesar felt obliged to publish his own objurgation, a sort of anti-eulogy that denounced the late hero of the opposition as a greedy, lecherous drunkard. Despite this war of words over a dead man's reputation, Caesar had named Brutus Urban Praetor for the year and had put him in the lists for a consulship a few years hence. Portia had inherited more than her plain looks from Cato. Like her father, she was said to be headstrong and demanding, not unlike a younger version of her aunt and now mother-in-law, Servilia. Perhaps that explained her appeal to Brutus. As Spurinna had said, in the end, it all comes back to pleasing our wives and mothers. Servilia stiffened a bit as Portia entered the room, and Brutus smiled and took her by the hand. "This visitor, my dear," he began, and introduced us again, repeating the line from Cicero. "And now we must all look to Gordianus to say something interesting and not frivolous." Three pairs of eyes turned on me, four, counting Davis. "You'll think me presumptuous," I began, and felt their scrutiny sharpen. "It was my son, Mito, I think. Yes, most definitely it was Mito." Servilia and Portia both looked to Brutus, who explained, "Adopted, freedman, on Caesar's military staff, helps with letters and memoirs and such." "Yes," I said to Mito, "now that I have need of such a thing, whom might I ask for advice? Some new man, perhaps?"
"Like Spurinna," said Davis, catching on and trying to be helpful.
"Yes, exactly, some new man like Spurinna." And Mito said, "By Hercules, Papa, certainly not. Don't go to the newest member for advice, go to the oldest, oldest by family at least, and that would be Marcus Junius Brutus. Ask him where to go. Loving Caesar as he does, Brutus will surely want the last of the dictator's new men to look his best on the Ides." All colour abruptly drained from Brutus's face. Portia, too, seemed to blanch, but Servilia merely looked vexed. "What on earth is this fellow talking about? Cicero was half right. Irritating indeed." "I think, Mother," Brutus began, then swallowed, looking a bit queasy. He dropped Portia's hand so that he could wipe a bead of sweat from his brow. "I think, well, I don't know what to think." He stared at me. "Are you saying I am to become a senator on the Ides?" It still felt very strange to say those words aloud, especially to such a man in such a house. Portia, the one I least expected to speak first, stamped her foot and clenched her fist. "Oh, that is the limit! Husband, why have you even allowed this person into our home?" Brutus spoke through gritted teeth that gave the false appearance of a smile. "I told you, my love, Cicero vouches for the fellow. And who is Cicero but another new man, a man with no ancestors, a nobody?" "Well, he's hardly that, my dear,"
Brutus looked pained. "We all have ancestors," I said quietly. "Even Cicero, even me. Else, how did I get here?" Brutus cleared his throat.
"But you said something about asking my advice?"
"Yes. I must purchase a new toga, a senator's toga, to wear on the Ides. As you can see, the venerable old toga I'm wearing today is so ancient and threadbare, I doubt the man who sold it to me is still in business. So I have no idea where I should go. You must know the best of the best." Brutus appeared to stiffen every time I mentioned the Ides. Was the idea of my becoming a senator so appalling that it actually made him flinch? Spurinna had buoyed my confidence. Brutus was demolishing it, but both recommended the same tailor.
"In some families," said Brutus, "it's a tradition for a son to wear one of his father's senatorial togas. But since in this case that isn't possible, then I'd say go to Mamercus, in the street of the ironmongers. His work is impeccable. Even if you need the order in a hurry, which obviously you do,
in time for the Ides." "Yes," I said, "I should probably go there at once."
"Yes, you probably should."
Even as I nodded and turned to leave, a figure wearing the red-bordered toga of a praetor appeared in the doorway. I recognized him only because Mito had pointed him out to me at public gatherings. Gaius Cassius was Brutus's brother-in-law, married to his sister. He was a tall, lean man of 40, beginning to bald a bit, as Caesar had done at that age. Like Brutus, his name was on the list Caesar had given me, but the dictator must have had some degree of trust in the man's abilities, since he had made Cassius a praetor and appointed him to be governor of Syria in the coming year, a job that would require considerable skills as both diplomat and military man. The current mess in Syria, as Caesar had called it, would have to be put straight if the dictator were to march confidently into Parthia with Syria at his back. Cassius's manner was very refined, even haughty. When he deigned to look at me, I saw a great deal of his clean-shaven chin. He proceeded to ignore me and spoke to Brutus.
"Brother-in-law, I'm afraid I can't stay any longer. I must meet some friends over on the Esquiline. We can continue our discussion later tonight. I'll bring the men I mentioned." "Yes, very well, all right then," said Brutus, who clearly had no intention of introducing me. So much for my prestige as a budding new senator.
To further distract my host, another figure appeared in the opposite doorway, which led to the private areas of the house. He was a red-bearded man of middle age, with the rumpled look of a philosopher or private tutor, which in fact he was. It was Portia who acknowledged him with a nod, giving him permission to speak.
"Apologies, mistress, but you asked me to let you know as soon as the boy finished his morning lessons."
"Yes, Artemidorus. I've promised him a midday excursion to the Capitoline Hill."
She turned to Cassius.
"I'm going to introduce him to the statue of Marcus Brutus. Can you believe he's never seen it?"
Then, to the little boy, who had appeared alongside his tutor,
"Not our Marcus Brutus, your stepfather, but the Marcus Brutus who lived long, long ago."
"And what did he do?"
"He dethroned the king,"
the boy cried enthusiastically, stabbing the air with his fist. Portia turned to Cassius.
"It's time he got to know some of the older members of the family into which he's been adopted."
She spoke as if the statue were a living person, not the image of a man dead for hundreds of years. I think there's a family resemblance between that Marcus Brutus and our own. The statue depicts an older man, of course, and with a beard, but otherwise my husband could have been the model.
"Yes, I've always thought they looked alike," said Cassius. "Handsome, but determined. So my little nephew is to have an adventure."
He bent his knees and clapped his hands, and the child went running to him. The boy sped past me, hesitated at the sight of hulking Davis, who gave him a friendly smile, then ran into the arms of Cassius, who lifted him high in the air.
"Careful, please," cried the tutor. "If you swing him about as you did last time, he'll have another nosebleed."
Looking at Artemidorus's distinctive red beard and recalling his name, I realized the Greek was not just any teacher, but a rather famous rhetorician from the city of Cnidus. His even more famous father, Theopompus, had taught Caesar. To instruct his own adopted son, Brutus had sought out the best of the best. Just as Artemidorus had feared, flecks of crimson appeared at the boy's nostrils as his uncle swung him around. A few drops of blood flew through the air and spattered Brutus. Brutus looked down at the tiny spots of blood and turned as white as his tunic.
"Oh, Gaius, you're too reckless. Look what you've done," snapped Portia, clutching Brutus's tunic, apparently more distressed by the stain on her husband than by her son's bleeding.
Looking chagrined, Cassius set the boy down. Servilia bent and held out her arms in grandmotherly fashion. But it wasn't to her, but to Artemidorus the boy ran. The tutor lifted the hem of his long tunic and pressed it to the boy's bloody nose. The moment was exquisitely awkward for everyone, including me. I raised my hand to catch my host's attention. Brutus looked at me blankly.
"With your permission," I said, venturing a step backward and taking Davis by the elbow.
"Yes, yes, of course," muttered Brutus.
No one else in the room was paying the least attention to me. I might have been invisible or a slave. Stepping out of the house, slipping a bit on the smoothly worn stone steps, I sucked in a deep breath.
"Such people," said Davis, shaking his head.
"What do you mean?"
"Such an old family, so respectable and all that," he said. "But when you gave them your news, not one of them congratulated you."
"Quite the opposite," I said, looking up at the sky. "Midday, or close enough. What do you say to a bite to eat? And perhaps a spot of wine, to brace my nerves," I thought.
"Yes, please."
Davis was seldom without an appetite. "Home?" "I think not."
"Where, then?"
"Follow me, big fellow."
Chapter 15. As we neared the salacious tavern, Davis grunted to show that he was not surprised at our destination. He had escorted me there and come to escort me home any number of times, and occasionally had whiled away an hour or so sharing a bit of wine with me, learning bad habits from his father-in-law, as Diana put it. The food at the tavern was only passable, but there was always something on offer. At midday it might not yet be too stale or too spoiled to eat. The tavern was nearly deserted. Having the pick of locations, I chose a corner with a clear view of the entrance, as my father had long ago taught me to do.
From the corner, you can see anyone coming toward you. The position can help defend a man from assassins, to be sure, but is also helpful in less contentious situations, as, for example, allowing one to compose one's expression accordingly and gain a slight advantage by seeing who has just entered the room before he sees you. So it was, only a few moments after we sat, that I saw Cinna step inside, looking a bit blinded by the change from light to dark. A few blinks later, he saw me and flashed a genuine smile of surprise. In the meantime, I had put on a frown of mock disapproval and shook my head gravely as he approached. "Tribune Cinna, back at the tavern again so soon? You've hardly had time to sober up from yesterday."
"I could say the same to you, Finder. Senator, I mean."
I silenced him with a forefinger to my lips. Some say this gesture springs from the resemblance of an upraised finger to a phallus, as both may be intended to ward off the evil eye. "You mustn't call me that yet. I'm still a mere citizen, thus free to indulge my vices as I wish, owing no explanation to the censor in charge of public morals or to the good citizens of Rome. And when you do become a senator, I shall hold you to a higher standard as you do me," Cinna laughed. "Besides, I came here to eat, not drink." "Now that is surely a lie. To eat and drink I can believe, since that's what I'm here to do, but not the one without the other. No one comes to the salacious tavern just to choke on stale bread or nibble some mouldy cheese. I hope we can do better than that." He clapped his hands to attract the tavern keeper's attention. "Wine for all of us, my good man, including this big fellow." Cinna nodded to Davis, with whom he had become acquainted on previous visits. "And bring whatever you have to eat that won't make us ill." The tavern keeper looked grieved. "We happen to have a bit of grilled fish caught in the Tiber this morning, served with a fine garum and olives on the side, and flatbread hot from the oven." "Sounds delicious," declared Cinna. Davis's stomach growled. "What brings you out on this lovely day, Finder, making the rounds of your soon-to-be colleagues?"
"Something like that."
"You might as well ask him, too," said Davis.
"Ask me what?"
Cinna raised an eyebrow.
I was puzzled for a moment, then realized what Davis meant.
"I need to acquire a new toga, of course, and on short notice, so I'm wondering—"
"Wonder no more. The fellow for you is Mamercus, located on the Street of the Ironmongers," we all three said together.
Cinna smiled. "I see I'm not the first to recommend him."
"I thought senators were supposed to disagree about things. How else can they hold a debate?"
"You're behind the times, Gordianus. Consensus is our watchword now. We have consensus on just about everything, thanks to the dictator."
"Even on the question of a tailor, apparently."
"Well, Mamercus is the best."
"Just as you are the best poet in Rome," I said, reaching for the cup of wine offered by the tavern keeper. When we all three held cups, Cinna raised his aloft.
"Here's to always demanding the best," he said,
"and never settle for less," I added, and at once made a liar of myself by emptying a cup of rather mediocre wine.
When he was young, my father-in-law was a friend of the best poet in the world, said Davis, endeavouring to say something useful. Cinna stiffened. Davis didn't understand how sensitive poets can be when ranked against other poets, even the dead.
I smiled. "My old
tutor, Antipater of Sidon, certainly thought he was the best poet in the world, and never hesitated to call himself that, though I'm not sure how many others thought the same. Besides, that was a long, long time ago. Antipater has been gone for, well, for almost a lifetime, it seems. Ah, yes, you've mentioned this connection to Antipater of Sidon before, said Cinna. It was he who took you to see the seven wonders of the world. We travelled together when I was young, yes. He's a great poet. There's no disputing that, though his work seems rather quaint nowadays. All those poems about Myron's statue of a cow. I happened to pass by Antipater's gravestone a few days ago and thought of you, so I paused to take a look at it. Quite extraordinary. And talk about old-fashioned. The images are a sort of rebus meant for the viewer to decipher. A rooster, a palm branch. I confess I couldn't make it out.
Yes, and the gravestone would be even more extraordinary if Antipater were actually buried there, I said.
What?
By Hercules, you've done it again, sinner, I muttered. I've let slip a secret, and for no reason other than your presence.
But you must explain. If the tomb of Antipater of Sidon is empty, why, that's just the sort of thing from which one might fashion a poem.
Perhaps. But the story is too complicated for me to recount it now.
Then you'll recount the story in your memoirs, I hope, along with everything else you can remember about Antipater. Aren't you thinking of writing an account of your life and travels?
By Hercules, how drunk was I when I told you that?
Very, which doesn't negate the idea. In wine, truth, or tall tales, at least. The readers won't much care which you tell, or if you mix them up together. I shook my head. No one writes memoirs these days except politicians, hoping to sway voters, or generals trying to secure a place in history. Oh, I'd much rather read the life story of Gordianus the Finder than that of Sulla, or even Caesar's war diaries. I sipped more wine. To be sure, I have met a great many interesting people, and I've witnessed great events, and the stories I have to tell might differ considerably from the official versions.
Exactly. Your memoirs would offer a different version of things. As you say, the memoirs of great men are mostly propaganda, entirely self-serving. I'm not sure that even the most honest man could give a true reckoning of his time. My daughter said to me only last night that the perspective of every man is different and yet the same, with the universe circling himself at the centre. Two men never share exactly the same truth, and the gods are just as self-centred, if we're to believe Homer.
Antipater? Homer? For a man as ill-read as yourself, you do like to drop names. You'll be talking about the good old days with Catullus next.
Catullus! You know I never set foot in this place without thinking of him. Poor, put-upon poet, lifting a cup here at the salacious tavern and longing for his Lesbia, I laughed. For a while, his poems gave this place quite an infamous reputation. You could hardly get in the door. Then the excitement died down. But you must have known Catullus much better than I did.
We were close for a time, Cinna nodded thoughtfully. Now there was a great poet, and a great judge of poetry as well. Do you know the compliment he paid me? Or rather, the compliment he gave to my Smyrna?
No, but I suspect I soon will.
Cinna cleared his throat. According to Catullus, my Smyrna will travel as far as the deep channeled streams of Cetracus,
The centuries will grow grey in long perusal of the Smyrna. A poem for all the world, and a poem for all the ages. So said Catullus.
The fish arrived, served on skewers. There was a bowl of garum for dipping, and another bowl with olives, and a generous piece of flatbread that we tore into three portions.
"Whatever happened to Catullus?" said Cinna.
"The last I heard, he was called to Verona on some family business, and he never came back. Then I heard he was dead, but no one seemed to know how or why. Then came the civil war, with death and confusion everywhere, and people forgot about Catullus. Not about his poems. Every literate person knows those by heart. But the man himself, and whatever became of him, is a mystery."
And gave me an arch glance. "Now there's a puzzle you might investigate, Finder, something to draw you out of retirement, the mystery of the vanished poet."
"I declined the case. I'm much too busy."
"Doing what?"
"For a start, I need to see that tailor about a toga. But before I do that..." I thought of Caesar's list of names.
"Yes?
I'm trying to think of an excuse to call on Mark Antony."
"Don't you know him?"
"Our paths have crossed, and my wife seems to be on surprisingly familiar terms with his wife. But Antony has become such an important fellow, I'm not sure I can trouble a consul with my little question about a tailor."
"Why not? I shall take you there myself."
"Right now?
Right now.
Without an appointment? I hardly need an appointment to call on my dearest drinking companion in the world, other than you."
"You and Antony?"
"Oh, yes. Before I took up with the likes of you and the other low-lifes in this establishment, I had the pleasure on countless nights of drinking till dawn with dear old Antony, reciting poetry back and forth, and challenging the other guests to outdrink us, which they never did. That was back in the good old days before he married Fulvia, when he was living with that lovely actress, the divine Cytheris."
"But your drinking companions no longer?"
"No. Antony is a reformed man, forever striving to please our dictator on the one hand, and his wife on the other. Oh, and also to please our fickle citizenry, who for some reason frown on having a drunkard for consul. The two of us are still great friends, and always will be, I hope. But, I shall put it bluntly, Antony is no fun any more. No fun at all. So drink up now, before we go, because we're not likely to be served a drop of wine at the consul's house."
Chapter 16
Antony's house was located on the southwestern slope of the Esquiline Hill. To reach it, Cinna, Davis, and I traversed the entire length of the forum, walking past gleaming temples and across grand ceremonial spaces. For a while, following Caesar's victory, the forum had become a strangely quiet, dreary place, depopulated by the deaths of so many among Rome's ruling class. Now the forum was bustling again, as senators and magistrates and priests and bankers crisscrossed the open spaces and gathered to talk on temple steps, attended by little armies of scribes and clerks and citizens seeking favours from them. Some of these senators looked rather foreign, sporting braided hair and long moustaches, and they sounded foreign too, chattering among themselves in their Gaulish dialect. Having crossed the forum, we ascended the Esquiline, and at last arrived at the House of the Beaks, so called because the vast dwelling had once been owned by Pompey the Great, who had decorated the huge vestibule with metal ramming beaks from ships captured during his illustrious campaign to rid the sea of piracy. After Pompey lost his head in Egypt, there had been a mad scramble by Caesar's supporters to lay hands
on his many houses and estates. Antony claimed the house of the Beaks. I had visited the house not long after Antony moved in, when he was living there with Cytheris. Though Cytheris thought them hideous, the ramming beaks had remained in place. Only the choicest of these trophies were displayed. It was said that Pompey had captured over 800 ships. I presumed that Antony had disposed of them. Who would want to keep a dead man's trophies as decoration to be seen by every visitor? But, to my surprise, the beaks were still there. As the three of us waited for word of our arrival to be conveyed to Antony, we strolled about the huge vestibule, gazing at the beaks. Sometimes one sees ships with crudely fashioned beaks, little more than man-sized lumps of bronze with a pointed end. But these were all amazing works of art, fashioned to look like griffins with ferocious beaks, or sea monsters with multiple horns. "Beautiful, aren't they, Finder?" said Cinna. "Fearsome, I would say."
"Beautiful and fearsome," said a voice I knew at once. I hadn't seen Fulvia in quite some time, not since her marriage to Antony, but her voice, like everything else about her, was distinctively her own, deeper than that of most women. Mannish, some called it, a word often used to describe Fulvia. The passing years had made her voice even deeper, giving it a pleasant huskiness that played upon the ear like silk upon one's fingertips. Fulvia had risen to prominence thanks to marriages to one powerful, ambitious, and doomed man after another. Her first husband had been the rabble-rouser Clodius, whose control of the mob gave him the run of the city. 8 years ago, Clodius had been murdered on the road his ancestor built, the Appian Way. Fulvia had staged his funeral as a grand political event that turned into a riot and climaxed with the burning of the Senate House. Her second husband, Curio, had been one of Caesar's most promising lieutenants, but Curio died early in the Civil War, killed by King Juba of Numidia, who desecrated his corpse and took his head for a trophy. After that humiliation, Fulvia had vanished from public view, reappearing in a seat of honour to view Caesar's African triumph, in which the late King Juba's infant son had been paraded as a victor's trophy. Her second widowhood ended with her marriage to Antony. He was arguably the most promising of her husbands, though it was hard to say how much any man's ambition mattered now that a dictator ruled Rome.
"That one is Antony's favourite." She pointed to one of the beaks, a spike that looked like a giant conical seashell. I looked at Fulvia instead. My association with her went back many years. When I had last seen her, she was still dressed in mourning for Curio. Her black mantle had framed a beautiful but brooding face, lined with bitterness. Now she had to be in her 40s, but actually looked younger than before. Strife and strain had been erased from her face, replaced by an expression that was at once happily optimistic and grimly determined. She was dressed in a sleeveless gown suitable for home wear, immodestly showing her shoulders and arms.
"I know that you, Gaius, have a rather soft spot for this one." Fulvia touched a beak cast in the form of a young sea nymph, with a smiling face, seaweed for hair, and small, bare breasts.
Cinna smiled. "It's the irony that strikes me. Imagine a crew of sailors being sent to the bottom of the sea after being rammed by such a pretty thing." He touched the cold metal, allowing his fingertips to linger on the girlish breasts.
Fulvia raised an eyebrow.
"Greetings, Gaius, and welcome."
She offered her cheek, to which Cinna pressed his lips. But the kiss never happened. Fulvia drew back very slightly, just as Cinna's lips might have touched her.
"And welcome to you also, Finder, and to your son-in-law."
No cheek was offered to me or Davis.
"I presume the three of you have come to see Antony, not me. You're in luck. He hasn't yet gone out for the afternoon. There's so much pressing business for a council. Every hour of every day, it never stops."
"Keeps Antony out of trouble," said Cinna.
"Most of the time," said Fulvia.
"I keep him out of trouble the rest of the time.
Follow me. I think he's in the garden."
As we were led through various rooms and hallways, I remember the last time I had been in the house, and how stripped of furniture and ornaments it had been. Hundreds of items accumulated by Pompey were being put up for auction by Antony, with the proceeds supposedly going to the public treasury. Some said that Antony, and others allied to Caesar, were simply enriching themselves, seizing properties and taking much, if not all, of the proceeds for their own use. There had been some friction between the dictator and Antony over the matter, but apparently the rift had been healed, since Caesar had seen fit to make Antony consul. And the house no longer looked empty. The many corners and walls and niches had been redecorated with furniture and paintings and statues, presumably brought in by Antony's new wife. One of the pieces, a small but striking bronze statue of a satyr cavorting with a goat, I recognized from a visit I had paid to Fulvia after the murder of her first husband. About the matter of confiscated property, Antony and Caesar had been reconciled. Now they were said to be at odds again, this time over Caesar's choice of a consul to replace himself and to serve alongside Antony after Caesar left for the Parthian campaign. Caesar intended to hand over the consulship to Dolabella, whom Antony detested. The question was to be decided at the meeting of the Senate on the Ides. It seemed a relatively small matter to me, but not, apparently, to Caesar, who had put Antony's name on the list he had given me. Perhaps Caesar feared that living in Pompey's house had given Antony ideas about becoming a second Pompey. More likely it was Fulvia who might goad his ambition to one day be called Antony the Great. I recalled words once spoken to me in confidence by Calpurnia. "Mark my words, Fulvia has her eye on our Antony, and if those two should ever join forces, beware." Perhaps Calpurnia's husband shared her apprehension. Deep within the house, completely secluded from the street, was an unusually large garden. Pebble-strewn pathways were bordered by small trees and shrubs, and decorated with bubbling fountains and elegant statues. The most prominent of these, because it stood in the garden's centre and towered larger than life over everything else, was a bronze statue of Bacchus. The god of wine and ecstatic release was shown in his youthful guise, wearing long, loose robes. Grapes and vines adorned his long hair and framed his boyish, beardless face. In one hand he held an upright spear twined with ivy, in the other a cluster of grapes. But the most striking details were the silver horns that sprouted from his temples. Statues depicting Bacchus with horns were rare, at least in my experience. He was said to reveal his horns only at the moment his frenzied female worshippers, called Maenads or Bacchantes,
were on the brink of the divine madness called Bacchanalia. "That wasn't here the last time I visited," I said to Cinna as we passed before the statue. "It wasn't among Pompey's decorations." "You're right. The statue arrived with Fulvia. Ironic that she brought with her the god of wine, but won't allow Anthony himself to play Bacchus." This wasn't the only change I noticed. When I had last been in the garden, there had been many dining couches piled with plump cushions set amid the little arbours of myrtle and cypress, elegant accommodations for the famously raucous parties held on warm summer evenings when Cytheris played hostess, and Antony quite literally played Bacchus, with ivy wreathing his brow and an endlessly replenished cup of wine in his hand. Those days were over. There was much less furniture now, and what there was looked much less comfortable. The corner where Antony sat, attended by scribes on either side, and with a table of scrolls before him, looked more like a magistrate's office than a place for Bacchanalia. Antony was formally dressed in his consul's toga, hemmed with a thick red border. He was dictating to one of the scribes, but stopped at our approach. His wide, ruggedly handsome face broke into a beaming smile at the sight of Cinna. He rose from his chair, and the two embraced. I was struck by the contrast. Cinna was slender and classically handsome. Antony, with his craggy brow and dented nose, was slightly shorter but twice as broad. "And here, Gordianus, let me embrace you as well." This came as a surprise, but I awkwardly submitted to a hug that squeezed every bit of air from my lungs. Antony had the build of a boxer and the strength of one as well. "Congratulations," he said, releasing me from the hug, but then gripping my shoulders as if he intended to crush them. In his enthusiasm, he started shaking me. I clenched my teeth to keep them from rattling. "Congratulations," he said again, finally stepping back. "But for what, Consul?" "Your appointment to the Senate, of course." "Ah, Gordianus, always so cagey, even when receiving congratulations. Well, you'd better get used to it. Come the Ides, you will be inundated with words of welcome and praise." "I will." "Most certainly. Think how many men in the Senate owe you a debt of gratitude for getting them out of some scrape or other, or helping them find evidence to destroy some villain in the law courts. You've made many a friend over the years." "And many an enemy," I said. "But how did you know of my appointment? I was hoping to give you the news myself." "These days, Gordianus, there's very little that happens in Rome that I don't know about. Part of my wife's bride gift was a network of spies she's built over the years. Fulvia's eyes and ears are everywhere. Everywhere! She makes the perfect consul's wife." He reached for Fulvia, pulled her close and gave her a kiss. She might have succeeded in making Antony a sober, hard-working magistrate, but staid he would never be. She accepted the kiss with an enthusiasm that surprised me, considering that three visitors and two scribes were present. The moment was rather touching, for there could be no doubt that their affection was genuine. Fulvia had finally found the mate she deserved. So, perhaps, had Antony. The kiss ended, but Antony held Fulvia close. "And congratulations to you as well, my dear Gaius," said Antony. "My life is so replete with accomplishments, I'm not sure for which of them you congratulate me," said Cinna. "For completing the new poem, you lout, and just in time for Caesar to read it before leaving for Parthia. Now that's writing to deadline. I've no doubt he shall love it as much as I do." I looked sidelong at Cinna. I thought Caesar was the first reader. "Indeed, he is.
the first reader of the complete poem, said Antony, but I've been privileged to hear bits and pieces of it over the years. I raised an eyebrow. Cinna told me he never recites from his work before it's published. Cinna looked a bit chagrined. Antony is the only exception to the rule. And what a lucky man that makes me, said Antony. Magnificent stuff, this new poem. The stories of both Orpheus and Pentheus are told, side by side, so to speak. Your description of the beheading of each is the stuff of nightmares. I shiver, remembering those lines. Then did his mother lift up the sundered head and kiss her son upon the mouth, and thought she felt him draw a shuddering breath. The passage of a breeze across the blood-wet emptiness of his severed throat. By Jupiter, Gaius, it's as if you were actually there to witness such a thing. I felt a chill down my spine. Once I had seen a man beheaded, Pompey, on the beach in Egypt, at a great distance, to be sure. That moment still haunted my dreams. I glanced at Fulvia, who had, by slow degrees, withdrawn from her husband's encircling arm, and I saw her turn pale. She, too, must be thinking of a real beheading, that of her husband, Curio, at the hands of Juba's soldiers in Africa. Looking at me and then at Fulvia, Antony realized the impact of his words and drew a sharp breath. But the poem is about much more than that, of course. Indeed it is, said Cinna quietly. I saw that Fulvia was staring at him with a strange, fixed gaze, as if to accuse Cinna of some impropriety, simply for having written such words. Words intended, I had no doubt, not merely to shock, but also to evoke the terror and pity that Aristotle held to be the highest accomplishment of art. "I think we must have some wine," said Antony. Fulvia shot him a piercing look. "But we must, my love. 'Tisn't every day that a fellow gets made a senator or finishes an epic, and here we have a chance to celebrate both." "Very well." Fulvia clapped to summon a slave and ordered that special cups be brought, along with a pitcher of Falernian. "Your favourite, as I recall," she said to Cinna. "Indeed it is." Fulvia turned to me. "I understand from your wife that those two slave boys I gave you are now down on the cup, pestering your son instead of you." Her interest in the matter was surely slight, I thought, but the question served to change the subject. "Yes, but Mopsus and Androcles are hardly boys any more. They've shot up like weeds in the last year or two." "They must be thriving, then. I'm glad. I do have fond memories of them." "Did she really?" It was sometimes easy for me to forget, when dealing with persons of her stature, that Fulvia was a woman like any other, capable of feeling genuine affection for her inferiors, as long as they didn't cross her. Mopsus and Androcles had assisted me when I looked into the matter of Clodius's murder, and afterward Fulvia made a gift of them. Had they remained in her household, I had to think it likely that they would have come to grief, given their penchant for getting into mischief. It was hard to imagine the woman who gave orders to Antony, granting leniency to a slave. The wine arrived and was served in decorated silver cups of extraordinary workmanship. The sculpted metal depicted a riot of drunken maenads amid leafy foliage, celebrating their love for Bacchus, who appeared on each cup in his youthful guise as the ivy-wreathed giver of wine and lord of abandon. Here, as on the statue, the young god's horns were clearly to be seen amid the grape clusters and vines on his brow. "Appropriate for the occasion, I thought," said Fulvia, addressing Cinna. "I presume Bacchus
must play a role in this new poem of yours, Gaius, since it's Bacchus whom Pentheus offends, for which crime the Maenads, including his mother, tear him apart?
Why, yes, of course, though the Maenads on these cuts appear to be having just a bit of innocent fun.
And in a few days, said Fulvia, after the Ides, Rome will celebrate the festival of Father Liber, who is none other than Bacchus under a very old Roman name. I'm honoured to be organising and playing host in this very garden to certain rituals of the Liberalia, those that are the exclusive domain of we plebeian women, as handed down by ancient custom. She turned her gaze to me. In preparing for the Liberalia, your wife and daughter have been very helpful to me, Finder. How gratified they must be at the great honour the dictator has granted you. I nodded. And to be sure, Bacchus has always been a favourite of my husband, to whom the god has in turn shown great favour.
I looked at Antony, thinking this was the moment he would offer a ritual toast. But he seemed content to keep silent and let Fulvia do it. She turned her gaze toward the statue of Bacchus at the centre of the garden.
So, as we drink, let the god be present among us in all his names and guises, Bacchus, Bromius, Father Liber, Dionysus, Euhan, Euhius, Eleleus.
With her cup raised to the horned statue and her eyes half shut, she sounded like a priestess as she invoked the god. This was a side of Fulvia I hadn't seen before, the pious Roman matron who took care that every occasion in her home, however great or small, should be pleasing to the god. I arrived home that afternoon quite exhausted by so much walking and a bit slow-witted from Antony's Falernian, which had replenished the silver cups of Bacchus more than once. Bethesda was delighted that Fulvia had mentioned her and appalled that I hadn't yet visited the tailor. Do it now, husband.
Now? There's no time. The sun is still up. Not for long. A fitting at a tailor can take hours. All the more reason to get it done right now.
Wife, desist! I'm tired and I wish to take a nap before dinner. I'll tend to the toga tomorrow. I had two slaves carry a sleeping couch and bring a warm coverlet to the garden. Bast the cat joined me, purring loudly as she burrowed between my legs. I drifted off to sleep, beset by unsettling thoughts. When had Roman wives begun to give orders to their husbands? When I was a boy, such disrespect for the head of the household was unheard of. Yet here was Fulvia, corralling Antony like a tamed bull and my own wife presuming to tell me what to do. I still found it hard to believe that the half-savage slave girl I purchased in Egypt long ago was now a Roman matron, thanks to the fact that I manumitted and married her, and consorted with the likes of Fulvia, quite possibly after Calpurnia, the most influential woman in Rome. What could the two of them have in common? Was it possible that my wife and Antony's, when in private and away from masculine ears, ostensibly making plans for some festival, in actuality shared observations and advice regarding the manipulation of their menfolk? Did there exist, unseen but not unfelt by men, a veritable conspiracy of women? Tomorrow, I promised myself, I would do as Bethesda demanded and take care of the toga. How absurd it seemed that in the days leading up to the all-important Ides, I should be so anxious about a mere piece of wool with a bit
of scarlet dye.